not violated anything.
Senior officials from all signatories to the nuclear deal, namely Iran, France, Germany, the UK, Russia and China, will gather in the Austrian capital on Tuesday to discuss ways to salvage the ailing accord. The Biden administration is also sending a team of experts to Vienna. Washington hopes to talk to the Iranian representatives over a step-by-step timetable that would bring both sides to compliance with the accord.
And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA.
There's no step-by-step plan, says Tehran. Iranian officials say the aim of the Vienna session would be to rapidly finalize the removal of all sanctions and nothing else.
Iran will not accept any step-by-step proposal. We think that there will be just one step, lifting all the sanctions. After the verification, Iran will come back to its commitment.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran responded by ramping up its enrichment of uranium and limiting international monitoring of its nuclear sites. Meanwhile, Biden has indicated that he's willing to clean up his predecessor's mess, but has taken no practical steps to do so. Observers say any headway should be made before Iran's presidential elections in June, which could lead to the formation of a new Iranian negotiating team and more delays.
So the bottom line is, there will be no direct or indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. in Vienna or anywhere else. Iran says any return by the U.S. to the nuclear deal will not need any negotiations. Once it's in the deal, Iran will reverse all its remedial steps and will go back to full compliance. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Most government hospitals have remained largely empty because of a nationwide strike action by resident doctors who constitute a large percentage of medical doctors in government hospitals in Nigeria. Consultancy rooms have remained empty because of the absence of medical doctors to attend to patients. Doctors' union officials said they are tired of the government failing to live up to its promises of settling their salaries and other benefits on time. Representatives of the Nigerian government met with labor leaders behind closed doors in a last-minute effort to avert the strike, but apparently the meeting ended in a deadlock. The government appealed to the doctors to consider the damage their withdrawal of services will cause to Nigeria's health system. But the resident doctors said the government should keep its several promises. This strike is coming at a challenging period, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic, with only about 800,000 Nigerians vaccinated. In a country with a population of close to 200 million, Nigeria has 163,000 COVID-19 cases, out of which 2,038 people have died so far. The doctors' union said all the resident doctors at the COVID-19 centers have joined the strike and withdrew their services. This doctor's strike is in progress just when the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is receiving treatment in a London hospital. According to union officials, close to 16,000 resident doctors are participating in this strike, which is indefinite. Most of the resident doctors are specialists who provide important healthcare services, especially in emergency wards. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, held virtual talks on Friday to discuss the fate of the agreement. During the meeting attended by China, Russia, France, Germany, and Britain, along with Iran, the signatories agreed to hold in-person talks in Vienna on Tuesday. That will be part of the meetings of the Joint Commission of the Nuclear Deal. Later, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed there will be indirect talks with Iran in Vienna.
These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA, and the sanctions relief steps the United States would need to take in order to return to compliance.
Tehran will hold no direct or indirect talks with Washington before it removes all anti-Iranian sanctions.
According to the immutable guidelines set out by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, any outcome of the joint JCPOA Commission meeting, which is based on the notion of step-by-step removal of sanctions, is unacceptable. According to the guidelines by the leader, the Islamic Republic will only return to its JCPOA commitments after the removal of all U.S. sanctions and Iran's verification of the move. The Islamic Republic will not hold any mediated or unmediated talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted. Just as the U.S. left the 2015 nuclear deal without negotiations and imposed sanctions on Iran, it should now remove all sanctions without talks.
Iran signed into the 2015 nuclear deal and committed itself to limiting its civilian nuclear program in exchange for removal of all nuclear-related sanctions against the country. That was meant to ensure Iran benefits economically from the accord, but those benefits were scarce and fully evaporated after the former U.S. administration withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and imposed unilateral sanctions against Iran. Analysts say all Iran is saying is that a once-negotiated deal does not need to be renegotiated.
The deal was the result of negotiations. So the negotiations have already taken place. The deal tells all sides what they're supposed to do. So the Americans know exactly what they're supposed to do. There's nothing to negotiate. If they want the deal to work, they have to implement it. But if they want to take bits and pieces and think that they can gain concessions from Iran, Iran is not going to do that.
Almost 3 months into the Biden administration, Washington is yet to right Donald Trump's wrongs on the nuclear deal. Tehran is clearly seeing through Washington's empty rhetoric and is calling for action. On Friday, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi told a virtual meeting on the nuclear deal that the remedial measures Iran took after the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal are reversible, but only after the removal of all anti-Iran sanctions and its verification by Tehran.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds, in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for ways to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violent crackdown on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qadil, occupied Ramallah.
The West and Russia are on a collision course again over Ukraine. The Kremlin has warned the Western military alliance NATO that any deployment of troops along the Ukrainian border with Russia would deteriorate the situation further. Moscow says it would be forced to take extra measures to ensure its own security if the U.S.-led NATO sends troops in support of Ukraine. That, a day after the Ukrainian president accused Russia of building up troops along the border amid renewed clashes between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian militias. Russia says its military presence on the border is not meant to threaten Ukraine. Moscow's response came after the U.S. warned last week against what it called Russian intimidation and pledged to stand by Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine have had a conflict centered on Crimea and Donbas regions since 2014. Tensions surfaced with Kiev and Moscow recently trading blame for a spike in violence in eastern Ukraine. In a recent meeting, NATO ambassadors condemned what they called Moscow's military buildup near Ukraine. However, the Russia foreign minister says the U.S.-led anti-Russia NATO campaign will ultimately destroy Ukraine.
Judging by the information published by the media, the majority of Ukrainian military forces understands the fatality of any actions leading to a hot conflict. I very much hope that they will not be incited by politicians, who in turn will be incited by the West, led by the United States.
The U.S. and European leaders are losing no time to denounce and threaten Russia, citing Ukraine. Tensions have been running high ever since Ukraine's Crimea region re-entered into Russia following a referendum. Since then, NATO has been expanding its Eastern Front. The United States missile systems in Romania and Poland, as well as American soldiers and military hardware in the region, are part of the military alliance game plan. Latvia and Lithuania are among destinations where NATO members have been sending their troops and weaponries. The reason? They lie right along the border with Russia. Apart from military deployments near Russia's borders, the West has imposed several rounds of sanctions against the Kremlin. It seems the continued pressure on Russia could plunge the two sides into another Cold War era and throw them and their allies into yet another vicious arms race.
As United States President Joe Biden keeps failing to honor his campaign promise to quickly undo the damage wrought by his predecessor on relations with Iran, Washington is grappling with the reality that it's now a very different geopolitical world. The just-signed $400 billion, 25-year Iran-China pact, which China's foreign minister called permanent, has been received with shock and awe across the Beltway. Washington's long-standing effort to totally isolate and blockade Iran has formally failed, while China's new ally provides a major energy obstacle to the Pentagon's militaristic pivot to Asia policy.
The foreign policy of the United States really does not change under Democrats or Republicans very much. So there's agreement in that area of the oligarchy on foreign policy. And foreign policy really is based on controlling basically the world.
The Economic and Security Alliance worsens the leverage of the United States, but they have repeatedly undermined their own bargaining position. In 2018, the United States illegally and unilaterally pulled out of the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program, and then began reimposing crippling economic sanctions designed to force Iran to renegotiate. Tehran insists compliance with the original pact is the only way forward and reiterated that the deal is still on the table if Biden returns the U.S. into compliance.
What should he do with Iran is he should get back into the agreement that Obama made, and we should be working with them to relieve the sanctions. They've actually done everything that the United States required of them. It's the foreign policy of the United States is totally immoral. So it's immoral towards Iran as it is in many other places.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani recently said that the lack of knowledge about Iran from American officials is ridiculous. Many analysts have been dumbfounded by the formal alliance. It's what many Americans now call woke, as it's between two nations of different colors, ethnicities, cultures, and cosmologies. Top American media is saying the next few weeks are make or break for the JCPOA, at least until September.
The Biden administration is reportedly scrambling to present a new offer to Tehran as soon as next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The debate.
It's called vaccine nationalism. What is it? In short, the hoarding up of COVID-19 vaccines. And who is guilty? Well, Western and developed nations like the U.S. and the U.K. Aside from the obvious reasons, why are they doing this, or should the question be, why are they allowed to do this, while other countries barely have enough, if any? As if the pandemic was not enough, now this is added to the COVID-19 mix to be covered in this edition of the debate.
How can you end a pandemic? Pandemics are global by definition. Unless vaccines are administered to all of the world's 8 billion inhabitants, COVID-19 is likely to live among us for a while. And what if some countries stockpile vaccines and refuse to share them with others? The pandemic will persist for the next few years, if not decades. That's the simple logic the UN chief has been trying to promote for months. This week, Antonio Guterres once again warned wealthy countries against COVID-19 vaccine nationalism and hoarding. The UN chief argued that it is not the best strategy to vaccinate everybody in one country before those most vulnerable are not vaccinated in the global south. He said it then becomes a danger even for the populations that have been vaccinated. Analysts say some wealthy countries are not only stockpiling vaccines, but using the global crisis as an opportunity to advance their positions.
These wealthy countries that would have to play a key role in making accessible medicine for any reason, not just COVID-19, we can see that they're not acting in good faith. I think it goes beyond nationalism. I think they saw an opportunity here, a global crisis, to take advantage of it to advance their own positions.
According to researchers at Duke's Global Health Innovation Center, high and upper middle income nations, which represent 1/5 of the world's population, have bought around 6 billion doses. This is why low and lower middle income countries have secured only around 2.6 billion. This includes 1.1 billion doses for the UN-backed COVAX program. So far, nearly 650 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines have been administered to people around the world. Figures show over 60% has been administered in high-income countries, which account for only 16% of the world's population. This is while dozens of countries are yet to receive a single jab. Over 131 million people have contracted a deadly respiratory disease across the globe, more than 2.8 million of whom have lost their lives. How many more casualties are needed for the wealthy countries to stop hoarding vaccines and ensure fairness in vaccine distribution across the globe? Equal vaccine access for all countries will help end this crisis.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred Desaias, joins us from Geneva. We also have author and international human rights lawyer Daniel Kobalik, who joins us from Pittsburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Alfred Desaias, let me first start with you. This warning has come, and a variety of outlets, I'm going to mention the United Nations, where the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has criticized, quote, many examples of vaccine nationalism and vaccine hoarding, as well as side deals, as he said, with COVID-19 vaccine manufacturers, in which he said it undermines access to all the people in the world. Tell us exactly what is going on.
Well, let's start with fundamentals. The right to health is not a commodity. Vaccines are, shall we say, our human right. And the Covenant on Economic and Cultural Rights stresses that in several general comments. Not only Secretary General Antonio Guterres, but also the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has said that. Also, the United Nations Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Mokokange, also the Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures, Alena Dohan, have said that. I have said that in several statements that I've made to press services. It's important to put the focus on the coordination activity of the World Health Organization. Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, already beginning of this year, spoke of a catastrophic moral failure, and he issued a declaration on vaccine equity. Yesterday in the Vatican, during the Easter Day blessing, Pope Francis, in his Urbi and Orbi statement, specifically focused on vaccine equity and the necessity to ensure the distribution of vaccine. There are countries that do not have even their first vaccine, including Timor-Este, Sierra Leone, Yemen, etc. It is clearly un-Christian and it is immoral and unethical to hoard these vaccines. And what makes it even more immoral is that countries like the United States, Canada, United Kingdom, and many European countries maintain economic sanctions against countries, thereby making it practically impossible for these countries to obtain vaccines, to purchase vaccines, to produce vaccines, to improve their chances of survival, to improve their hospital infrastructures, etc. So there's a huge complex of human rights violations, which in my opinion should be sent up to the International Court of Justice through a resolution of the General Assembly under Article 96 of the UN Charter, requesting an advisory opinion saying this entails crimes against humanity. And the crimes against humanity are being committed deliberately by the West.
Okay, this is very interesting. Daniel Kobalik, didn't have that on the lineup of questions that I had, and I'm glad you have Alfred Desaias talk about that. So let me ask your for your insight on this. I mean, this definitely is another branch of this whole debacle that's, in a sense, taking place, where you have countries that are hoarding the vaccines, like the U.S., U.K., France, and at the same time, they have exercised sanctions, in particular the U.S., against countries that can't get the vaccine into their own, for their own population, which, according to Alfred Desaias, they should be taken up to the ICC. So that's a grave violation of human rights, to say the least.
Yes. Well, and I agree with Dr. Desaias on this issue, and I'll see him and raise him. Not only is the West hoarding the vaccines from countries who are being sanctioned by the West, of course, the West is hoarding it from countries they're actively at war with, including Yemen, which Dr. Desaias mentioned. which is now either on the verge of famine or fully in famine right now, because of the U.S.-backed Saudi war there that's continued since 2015. Afghanistan is another example, of course. Syria, another example. Libya, you know, where the West has either actively at war with those countries or recently at war and has left those countries devastated and still is not providing vaccines for those countries. To me, this is really a crime against humanity, if not even genocidal. And then you look at a case like Cuba, where Cuba has several vaccines right now that it is testing. It probably would already have these vaccines online, which it would freely share with other third world countries, as we know that's what Cuba does. But the sanctions have slowed Cuba down greatly. Again, not from only being able to have the vaccine for its own people, but from being able to develop it in aid of other countries. So we see human rights violations, crimes against humanity, compounded on each other when we talk about this issue.
Professor Zayas, one of the words that stuck out in this array of facts regarding the hoarding was the word concessions. And I'm going to put this into context for you, where there are indications, as this one report said, that the G7 countries, well, they're listening with the leaders of France, the UK, and the US, and they are suggesting that they're going to make some concessions on vaccines during this meeting which took place, hosted by the UK. I mean, I'm not too sure. When I see that word, it's as if they're saying, okay, we'll let some countries have some of the doses that we have, like the US, which even though they have 600 million doses, they may have more at this point, they have not followed through on their concessions, quote unquote. That just, in a sense, bothers the mind to think that they're willing to save lives, possibly, by saying that. That's the impression, at least, that it gives off.
Of course, and that's what it is. The problem is privatization of health. I mean, unless you understand health as a global public good, you understand that there is a human right to health. And most of these countries are state bodies to the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights that actually stipulate the right to health. That means that all of these countries are actually violating the provisions of the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. There's also the right to international solidarity. My colleague Virginia Dandan from the Philippines, rapporteur on solidarity, issued a declaration on the right to international solidarity. Needless to say, it was boycotted by the United States and boycotted by the European Union. Same thing happened recently in the Human Rights Council last week as resolutions were adopted. There was a resolution which specifically condemned the practice of imposing economic sanctions, in particular, now during the pandemic. This was adopted by 30 votes in favor, 15 votes against, and who were among the 15? The European Union countries. Now, how can you, on the one side, argue, advocate civil and political rights, and then so completely ignore economic, social, and cultural rights? But it's not just economic rights. The right to life belongs in the category of civil and political. So actually what we're dealing with here is a major violation of the right to life through a violation of the right to health. I come back to my proposal. This must come up before the International Court of Justice, because if a rapporteur like me or Duhan or Mofokeng condemn this kind of practices, this kind of sanctions, this kind of blackmail, That's very fine and good. But you need the highest judicial instance of the United Nations to say this entails a crime against humanity. You also have to send it to the International Criminal Court. They have competence to declare it a crime against humanity.
Sure. Well, the depth of this is still being explored as to what can be done when you take a look at, for example, this Duke University, whose researcher has said, who has been analyzing the deals, said that countries with deals for the COVID vaccine have priority manufacturing slots for this year, 2021, which means that even if other countries make purchases now, they may have to wait months or even a year for the delivery. And, well, as a result, you have high-income countries who have 16% of the world's population but currently hold 60% of the vaccine doses that have been purchased. So, Daniel Kovalik, that leaves basically this means money talks. And this means that these countries that don't have the money may not be getting the vaccine anytime soon. There needs to be something done here. There needs to be some type of action, as our guests there mentioned quite rightly, so maybe through the UN or then eventually the ICC. How do you think this can be at least somewhat controlled for fair distribution?
Well, I totally agree with my colleague, Dr. Desais, that this is a matter for the ICJ and the ICC. It's hard to think of a greater crime than what is happening right now with, as you say, this hoarding of vaccines that are being made largely for profit, huge profit, while, again, the lion's share of the world's population goes without. You know, and the other thing I question is, what will the world look like if this is not ameliorated? You're going to have only the northern hemisphere that has the vaccines. The southern hemisphere will be left largely without it. What will be done with those people? You're going to have a giant gated community in the West, and that's very concerning. Obviously, this will lead to more human rights abuses, both under the covenant on political rights and the covenant on economic, social, and cultural rights, as Dr. Desais says. Something needs to be done immediately. I agree, it has to happen through the United Nations, and it has to happen through the General Assembly, because, of course, the Security Council is locked up by the veto power of countries like the United States and the UK, who probably would try to stop any affirmative action from happening to help the Global South. So it does have to happen through the General Assembly, and I'm glad Dr. Desais also mentioned the Pope's words on Easter Sunday, which I think were very important, and which I hope Christians and Christian nations abide by and listen to and heed, because otherwise we're looking at a world, a dystopic world, very much in the near future.
Well, Afra Desais, I have to mention this also. I mean, we could talk about this aspect, which is becoming kind of like shock revelations. For example, South Africa. Why does it have to pay twice as much for vaccines as European countries? Why has Africa, home to 1.3 billion people, been allocated just 300 million doses? So that's another shock statistics there. But I think the motion for something to be done is something that perhaps you, in your capacity as a former UN Special Rapporteur, you made your suggestions already. But really, what can be done? I mean, there needs to be, before there's going to be some kind of social breakout when the world becomes lopsided with just G7 countries getting vaccines and the rest of the world lagging behind, losing their innocent population. So from here on, what can be done?
Well, the Secretary General has been sensitized, and he's been speaking about it, not now, but already in 2020. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General of the World Health Organization, has been speaking thinking about this and has invoked the international health regulations and obviously the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, the Rapporteur on the Right to Health, the Rapporteur on Sanctions, etc. But words will not make it happen. The General Assembly has to have an emergency session. I would like to call for an emergency session of the General Assembly to elevate these issues to the International Court of Justice for an advisory opinion that will finally say that a vaccine and the right to health is not a commodity. And this must be ensured by the international community. That is why the United Nations was created, for multilateralism, for cooperation, for international solidarity. And me, as a practicing Catholic, I consider that the actions of many Western countries that call themselves Christian entail what we term in Catholic parlance mortal sin. We are directly responsible for the deaths of countless people in the third world because we make it nearly impossible for them to obtain the vaccine.
Right.
So this is not only a legal question, it's an ethical question, it's a moral question.
Indeed. We're going to have to unfortunately leave it there. Thank you very much. Former UN Special Rapporteur Alfred de Zayas there from Geneva, thank you for your thoughts there. And author and international human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik, thank you so much, from Pittsburgh. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikko Vitale, my entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In a move that was condemned by environmental justice advocates, President Joe Biden's administration has sent 500 unaccompanied asylum-seeking minors to Fort Bliss, a highly contaminated and potentially hazardous military base in El Paso, Texas, and is reportedly considering using additional toxic military sites as detention centers for migrant children in U.S. custody. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As Biden Ramps Up Detention Capacity, Group Warns Contaminated Military Bases Are No Place for Kids. Here's the details. In a move that was condemned by environmental justice advocates recently, President Joe Biden's administration recently sent 500 unaccompanied asylum-seeking minors to Fort Bliss, a highly contaminated and potentially hazardous military base in El Paso, Texas, and is reportedly considering using additional toxic military sites as detention centers for migrant children in U.S. custody. We are extremely concerned to hear of plans to detain immigrant children in Fort Bliss. Military bases filled with contaminated sites are no place for the healthy development of any child, Melissa Legg, an attorney at Earth Justice, said in a statement. We recognize that the humanitarian situation at the border needs to be addressed in humanity, compassion, and expediency, Legg continued. Part of that requires keeping children away from toxic military sites. While we are hopeful that the Biden administration will keep children safe, we remain vigilant and ready to continue protecting detained minors in toxic facilities, she added. Immigrant children under the care of the federal government should not be in cages, let alone toxic sites in military bases. The Biden administration has recently announced that facilities at Fort Bliss would serve as temporary housing for up to 5,000 unaccompanied minors, the El Paso Times reported recently. The Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, said it will reserve the Fort Bliss accommodations for boys ages 13 to 17. Military personnel won't staff the site or provide care for the children who are in the custody and care of HHS. There are 17,641 unaccompanied asylum-seeking minors in U.S. custody as of Tuesday, according to ABC News. Over 5,600 children are being held in overcrowded facilities run by Customs and Border Protection, CBP, which falls under the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, while more than 12,000 are under the supervision of HHS. Although DHS is supposed to transfer minors to HHS's Office of Refugee Resettlement within 72 hours, after which children are housed in one of more than 200 HHS-approved shelters in 22 states until they can be placed with a family member or another suitable sponsor, thousands have been stuck for far longer than legally allowed in squalid conditions. Recently, the White House came under fire for restricting media access to CBP's detention facilities, which some journalists have described as border jails. As the El Paso Times noted, HHS characterized Fort Bliss as an emergency intake site and a temporary measure to quickly remove the children from the custody of the Border Patrol. Earth Justice argues that the Biden administration's plan to use military bases, many of which the group says are known to be riddled with toxic hazards from past military operations, spills, storage of toxic medicals, unexploded ordnances, and firing ranges to expand its capacity to temporarily detain unaccompanied children is no solution. According to Earth Justice, 130 military bases and installations are considered priority Superfund sites by the Environmental Protection Agency. There are currently 651 Department of Defense and National Guard sites potentially contaminated by toxic chemicals known as PFAS, short for per- and polyfluoroacyl substances. PFAS don't easily break down, and they can persist in your body and in the environment for decades. Several of the military sites being considered by the Biden administration are contaminated with potentially hazardous pollutants, and some are even located on or near Superfund sites, Earth Justice said. The organization continued, Superfund sites under consideration for housing children in immigration custody include the Homestead Detention Facility in Homestead, Florida, Moffett Field in Mountain View, California, and Joint Base San Antonio in Texas. Many of the sites remain inadequately remediated and is still contaminated. Without proper environmental reviews, there is no way to guarantee these sites are safe for children, potentially exposing them to toxic chemicals that could have lifelong health impacts. Fort Bliss is no exception. As Justice, along with partners including Alizna Nakolo do Campesias and the National Hispanic Medical Association, released hundreds of documents of searchable documents and an expert analysis of previous plans for construction of a temporary detention center for children and families at Fort Bliss. These records document several problems with the project, including that the Army did not adequately investigate to determine what types of waste had been disposed of at the site, that the methods used for testing the soil samples were inadequate or never completed, and that samples taken after the supposed cleanup still had concerning levels of pollution. Additionally, illegal dumping on the site may continue to this day. As a result, there is now even greater uncertainty about the environmental hazards at the site and a greater need for thorough testing, analysis, and cleanup. We are deeply concerned about the decision to open temporary detention facilities for minors at Fort Bliss and the potential health risks to the minors detained in tent there, said Dr. Elena Reyes, president of the National Hispanic Medical Association, a client in Earth Justice 2018 FOIA lawsuit regarding the base. Based on what we found in our Fort Bliss investigation in 2018, she added, there are still present toxins from past landfills, which means children could be forcibly exposed to toxicity linked to cancer and development defects. Despite the GOP's dehumanizing and misleading narrative that a border crisis is afoot, there has not been an uncharacteristic surge in migrants entering the U.S. at the southern border, but rather a predictable bump in border crossings that typically happens at this time of year, augmented by the arrival of people who would have come in 2020 but could not due to the clampdown on immigration during the COVID-19 pandemic, as the Washington Post reported recently. An HHS statement on the transfer of migrant children to the military base in El Paso said that the use of the Fort Bliss facility will have no impact on the Department of Defense ability to conduct its primary mission or on military readiness. The deference to militarism is telling. According to Representative Jamal Bowman and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, it is impossible to understand the arrival of asylum seekers at a U.S.-Mexico border without taking into account the role played by U.S. imperialism. As Common Dreams reported recently, the two progressive lawmakers made the case that the root causes of migration from Central America and Mexico to the U.S. can be found in decades of interventionist foreign policy, profit-maximizing trade and carceral policies, and the climate crisis, all driven by the pursuit of capitalist class interest. Citing the U.S. government's flagrant disregard for the health of those in custody, as Justice called for the immediate halt of any plans to place children in such unsafe facilities, the securing of safe and suitable housing for children while they are required to remain in the care of the Department of Health and Human Services, and the development of solutions that do not involve placing children on or near toxic sites, military sites, or in detention-like settings.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.